We're glad you're here tonight, and we'd remind you of the question period that should follow in about 30 minutes. Actually, this one doesn't cut in the middle too well. We'll go a little bit longer, I think, in the first session and then be shorter in the second. But we're talking about the record of the rocks, and by the rocks, we're talking about the top layer of sedimentary rock that covers the continents. I know many are not geologists and maybe have not studied that, but sedimentary rocks are rocks that are laid down by water, and we've got many layers. You drive along the road cuts on the highway and you see these layers of rock. They're horizontal generally, unless they're pushed up from mountains in a mountainous area. Why do we have these layers of rocks, and why are they horizontal? Well, they're laid down by water. And they go much further down than most of us realize. They go down an average of over a mile. Now, of course, it's much further than that down to the center of the earth. But there is this mile and a half of sedimentary rock that covers the continents, water-laid rock. And in those rocks, in those layers of rocks, are billions and billions of dead things. So we've got billions and billions of dead things in rocks laid down by water that cover the continents. Now, I don't think you have to do a lot of thinking about that to get a pretty good idea of what would cause something like that. Sedimentary rock that covers the continents to an average of about a mile and a half all over the world with billions and billions of dead things in it. Now, the evolutionist tells us that this is the result of a slow, gradual buildup over billions of years. If you were here last night, I think you see some difficulty in that kind of an explanation. It just does not work and won't explain what we see in the rocks. I believe it's a rapid, catastrophic deposition, a year-long series of catastrophes that we read about in the book of Genesis. Well, let's look at the facts and see which of the two models is served best by the evidence. The evolutionary representation of these sedimentary rocks is seen here in the geologic column. And we're told that as you look at these layers of rocks down toward the bottom, you have the simple organisms. And as you come up toward the top, you have the more complex. And that's because it records the millions of years of evolution over time. This is the slow progression of millions of years of evolution depicted. The biggest problem with this is you can only find it in the textbooks. You can't dig down in the earth and find it anywhere. And geologists know this, though they really don't like to admit it, and it's not the impression they leave in the textbooks. Notice the statement by Leet and Judson. This is a standard college geology textbook. Because we cannot find sedimentary rocks representing all of Earth time neatly in one convenient area. In other words, don't expect to find this in one spot. We must piece together. We can't find it in one spot. We have to piece it together from the rock sequence from locality to locality. They get some over here and they get some over there. This process of tying one rock sequence in one place to another in some other place is known as correlation. And so it's correlated, stacked together, not because you find it in one place, but you find it in all kinds of different places, and then it's pieced together. Well, how do you know how to piece it together? What goes on top and what goes in the middle? How can you tell? Well, if you're an evolutionist and you find a rock with a simple organism in it, where do you put it? It ought to be on the bottom, and that's the way it's built. Now, that's somewhat oversimplifying, but first we need to understand that this is, as the Encyclopedia Britannica says, a mental abstraction. This product of correlation called the geologic column is not what you find anywhere that you dig down in the earth, but it's a mental abstraction that you piece together. Now, the correlation process itself is not proof of evolution because it assumes the thing to be proved. That's called circular logic. Notice the way it's expressed by R.H. Rascal of Cambridge University in the Encyclopedia Britannica. He says it cannot be denied that geologists are here arguing in a circle. The succession of organisms has been determined by a study of the remains embedded in the rocks, and the relative ages of the rocks are determined by the organisms they contain. Round and round they go. Let me illustrate, again somewhat oversimplifying, but this is really the basic process that's used. A person says, this is a primitive fossil. Okay, how do you know it's a primitive fossil? Well, it's found in an old rock. All right, that makes sense. But how do you know that this is an old rock? Well, it's got a primitive fossil in it. See, and what are we proving here? We're not really proving anything. But this is the way it's correlated. Now, once you correlate it and stack it together, it looks like evolution, but it's because you believed in evolution to start with. That's how it got stacked that way. So that's obviously not proof. Now, circular logic is not always bad in science if we understand that's what we're doing and if we don't use it as proof. This is what we do when we produce a model. But we don't think once we produce the model and then illustrate it that that's proved because we can illustrate it. It's the thing that we need to then test to see if it fits the facts. And that's the proper use of this kind of an illustration. This is the proposed model. Does it fit the facts? I think when you test it against the evidence, you find it doesn't fit at all, and that's pretty much the theme song that we'll be following this evening. The first problem that I want to point out is that we're looking here in this illustration at mostly animals with backbones, the vertebrates. But you don't find vertebrates virtually, I mean, they're just very few relatively, in the geologic column. It's skewed to misrepresent the picture. The fossil record is almost all marine invertebrates, animals without backbones that lived in the ocean. You have about 4.5% of the 5% that's left, plants and algae. Well, where are the vertebrates? Well, there are a few of them, less than 1/100th of 1% are vertebrates, but that's all you see in the geologic column. But why do you show all vertebrates and not virtually all marine invertebrates? Well, somebody might get the idea that this was a flood deposit, which I think is exactly what it is. And when you understand the nature, what it is composed of, I think that argues in itself for a flood deposit. The founders of the discipline of geology all believed that that's what it was. We mentioned on the radio this afternoon Nicholas Steno. He's referred to as the father of modern stratigraphy, the study of the strata, or geology. And here in Dotton Batten's Evolution of the Earth, again a standard geology textbook, we read, besides correctly interpreting fossils, the result was the formulation of the most basic principles for analysis of Earth history. Steno showed great insight. Now here's the hero of geology. He's the one that got it started and figured it all out. Steno's axioms provide ultimately the basis of practically all interpretation of Earth history, so their importance can hardly be overemphasized. He's the hero of geology. The problem with the representation in the textbooks is that they leave out a very significant fact. You would think that he believed in evolution just like they did from the presentation they give. When I was doing work at Cambridge in England, they had under glass in the Trinity Museum this particular book, which was one of the earliest editions of Steno's book. And you look at the dedication page, it's dedicated to the proof of the Noachian deluge. That's what his concept of geology was founded on. He believed it all came about as a result of this year-long series of catastrophes in the flood, that it was a year-long flood deposit. This statement was acknowledged, and I've not seen it before, but finally, last year, in the journal Geology, Steno believed in the universal flood throughout his life. Very interesting article about him that acknowledged things that, and I've had professors argue with me on college campuses. He couldn't have been a flood geologist, and I had to go back and get pictures of his book to prove it. I think the flood provides a much better explanation for the rock record. than this slow, gradual buildup that's typically presented in the textbooks. The book, The Genesis Flood, was published in 61 and really produced a revolution. Here's a geologist and a theologian together producing a book that describes what we see in the rock record and seeks to explain it with the flood. John C. McCampbell is an evolutionist. He is a professor and head of the Department of Geology at the University of Southeastern Louisiana. Produces a lot of geology, geologists, especially petroleum geologists. He wrote the foreword to this book, even though he would disagree with the conclusions. Nevertheless, he was fair enough to say that this explanation does fit the facts that we observe in geology, and that they build a very strong case for this explanation, and they present a very serious challenge to the view that's usually presented in the textbooks. Now, he didn't come out and say their view works, our view doesn't, but it was pretty close. And I think that is the case. This book published in 61 really spawned the creation movement that we're now the beneficiaries of today. People will say, okay, I understand a flood piling up a lot of sediment, but how would it produce ordered sequence? We see Cambrian rocks can be identified as Cambrian rocks because you've got certain kinds of animals in it that are different from Silurian and different from Devonian. And how wouldn't a flood just mess everything up? Mix them up together? No, I don't think that's... In fact, when you study flood deposits, you see that water is a very, very effective sorting agent. Plus, you've got different environments all over the world. I think we would have those segregated habitats, ecological zones, preserved, burying things where they live. Things on the bottom of the ocean would preserve things that live on the bottom of the ocean. The flood would. The worldwide flood would bury organisms where they lived. And then as the water rose, we would see different environments preserved, buried again where they were, so that the end result would be segregated critters. Things that lived in the swamp would typically be buried with things that lived in the swamp, and wouldn't be buried with things that lived at the bottom of the ocean or out on the plains, so that groups are buried separately, not because they lived millions of years apart, but because they lived in different places. And I think that explains very well what we see in the rock record. Now, you don't find this kind of ordered segregation. This is artificially stacked together, as we pointed out. But you do find groups together and groups segregated, which are then stacked. So this is an arranged, skewed in terms of looking at or displaying vertebrates rather than marine invertebrates. It's a conceptual correlation. It's useless as proof of evolution, but it is useful as a model. This illustrates the concept. If evolution were true, you should be able to represent it this way, and the facts should be consistent with this representation. It is useful then to test against the evidence. But now, how do you test the idea? Let's let the evolutionist tell us how that should be done. Stephen Stanley is from Johns Hopkins University, an atheist, an expert in this field, and he says topsy-turvy fossils provide a test. He says they would disprove evolution. Any topsy-turvy sequence of fossils would force us to rethink our theory. What does he mean by that? If you find something that's supposed to be down at the bottom of the column, up at the top, or if you find something at the top down at the bottom, that would do it. Now, we do find a lot of things that are supposed to be at the bottom that are still alive today. Well, we find so many of those that they really don't consider that very good evidence, because not because it's not logically compelling, but because we just know there's a lot of that sort of thing. Niles Eldridge, who is curator of the American Museum of Natural History, professor at Columbia University, talks about living fossils in his book by that name, and the book entitled Fossils. But he has several chapters dealing with the living fossils, and he says there seems to have been almost no change in any part we can compare. And evolution involves change, and they should be seen to be changing, but no, they're still alive today, and they're just like they were back toward the beginning. We looked at some bacteria like that the other evening. We've not completely solved the riddle of living fossils. Maybe the most famous, or certainly one of the most famous, would be the coelacanth. This is a fish that lived at the same time as the dinosaurs, and some of them are just beautifully preserved. The book Living Fossil was written by Keith Thompson, a very famous evolutionist. He says this is a fish thought to be extinct for 70 million years. In other words, we had exactly the same evidence for extinction for this that we did for the dinosaurs, because you see them at this point in the column and then not above that, at least the way it's stacked together. But this is fish was a coelacanth, animal that thrived concurrently with the dinosaurs, and it looked quite like the modern forms. Now wait a minute, it's extinct for 70 million years. Well, we thought it was, but yes, now we have found modern forms. We have no fossil coelacanths younger than the late Cretaceous. Now here we are about the middle of the column, and they disappear. Well, according to the evolutionary view, this is a gradual buildup over millions of years. If they disappear, that means they went extinct. And we go all the way up to the top, and there's nothing until we look around in the ocean, and there they are swimming around. We've caught over 600 of them now in the last few years. They're not extinct. Well, then the fact that you don't have it from halfway up the column up to the top, they disappear, proves what? Doesn't prove extinction. It just proves they live down here, and they're still alive, but they got buried where they lived. They were segregated because of environment, not because of a time period. So we have a lot of these that are supposed to be down that are up, and he has probably 100 of them that he lists in his book. But the real thing that they look for in terms of falsifying this column or testing it would be things that are alive today found down at the bottom, or what they define as the bottom of the geologic column, because that they weren't supposed to have been around back then. Something could exist, I suppose, without leaving a fossil for millions of years. That's hard to imagine, still be alive today. But how would you get these elephants that hadn't evolved back down at the bottom when they were just beginning to have life forms? That would be the turvy fossil, if you please. Richard Dawkins frankly acknowledges the implications. He says, we should be very surprised, for example, to find fossil humans appearing in the record before mammals are supposed to evolve. If a single well-verified mammal skull were to turn up in 500 million-year-old rocks, our whole modern theory of evolution would be utterly destroyed. Now, he's not quite as honest as that sounds. Sorry. We'll illustrate that in a moment. What he's really doing here is meeting the objection that evolution is not falsifiable. We talked Monday night about the requirement of falsifiability or testability. And he's saying, well, you know, a lot of things can't be tested, but this fossil record really can, because if you found this, I mean, here's a test, it would be falsified. And that's arguing for its scientific nature. And I think he's right. I think this is falsifiable. And this portion of evolution would be. But it's not as falsifiable as you think, because we found that kind of thing, like the modern humans at La Salle, Utah, that are found in the same formation as Dinosaur National Monument. Humans are right there with the dinosaurs. They're supposed to be 100 million years apart, according to the geologic column. That's way before they're supposed to be on the scene, the very thing he called for. And so we go back to his quote, and we see the key expression here is well verified. If you get it verified, then it would destroy, but it ain't going to be. If you find humans with the dinosaurs, that means they fell down a crack or they crawled back in the cave and it collapsed. Some kind of explanation, it was eroded and redeposited. This can't be together, because we know dinosaurs and humans didn't live together. They're 100 million years apart, and so... And you, of course, you can move bones around. Bones really are not as good in terms of evidence as we might think they would be. We went back to this site to see if we could verify it. It's an open pit copper mine just about 20 miles south of Moab, and I've been there several dozen times excavating, and we now have 10 human skeletons that have been found from this area, some 50 feet down in the Dakota Sandstone, about where the backhoe is in this illustration. Here you can see one still embedded in the rock, the pelvis on the lower right-hand corner, the foot over toward the lower left-hand corner, the knee up top, together, as in life, articulated. Most of them, though, are just kind of scattered bones like these. Some of them look like they go together, or really don't. They're just piled together. But these are human bones in the layer with the dinosaurs. Most of them are replaced with malachite, but they're perfectly modern bones. They have no collagen, which would indicate they've been dead. The typical implication is about 1,000 years, or at least 1,000 years, maybe more, but at least 1,000 when you have no collagen. This is an excellent turvy fossil. We talked to the fellow who uncovered this initially, who was driving the bulldozer at the point 50 feet down there at the copper mine. He says there were no cracks, there were no caves, no broken layers, perfectly consistent. They just ran into them 50 feet down in the Dakota Sandstone. We're looking here at a view of the area. Actually, the mining operation of the 30s is represented up here at the top, and they hit rock that was so hard it was tearing up the bulldozers, and so they stopped and didn't start again until the 70s, and then came on down to this level where they found the skeletons that we're talking about. The diagram of that side view looks like this. The road cut was actually cut in the 30s, but prior to the 30s, and here's where the skeletons are, prior to the 30s, it looked like this. And so if these skeletons are older than 1930, then we see obviously they are 50 feet down. There's no way to have this as an intrusional burial. And several of the radiocarbon dates indicate several thousand years. There's a spring here that contaminates it. I don't think we can get accurate ages, but certainly older than 1930, and the replacement with malachite and the no collagen would argue very strongly for that as well. These were not intrusionally buried, and his dodge on the issue really doesn't work. But going back to his statement, he continues, saying we should be very surprised, for example, to find fossil humans. It would utterly destroy, you found them there in the wrong place. And he continues, ironically, it's also the reason why creationists are so keen on the fake human footprints, which were carved during the Depression, the fool tourist, in the dinosaur beds of Texas. Now, from behind his desk in Oxford, he can tell that they're carved. They have to be fake because humans and dinosaurs were 100 million years apart. He just knows that. And so they have to be fake and they have to be carved. But the reason creationists are so interested in is because this is really better evidence. You can't erode a footprint and redeposit it, can you? It can't fall down a crack. I mean, it's where it's at. And so it avoids some of the explanations that they can give for bones. It cannot be intrusionally buried. Dinosaur Valley State Park near Glen Rose, Texas, is one of the areas he was talking about. It's famous for its dinosaur tracks. The Paluxy River runs through the middle of it. And for years we've known that there are just all kinds of just spectacular dinosaur tracks here. The three-toed tracks, the more sauropod, more like an elephant's foot, are famous. In addition to these depressed tracks, we also have the slightly raised tracks that you see here, which really caused some questions. How do you get a raised track? Well, the dinosaur steps, it's filled in with other material after it leaves that depression, and then it's filled up with material that then hardens harder than the material around it. And when you have erosion, then the center part, the infill, is more resistant to erosion and is slightly raised. And that's important in understanding some of the things that we'll see later on. But in addition to tracks that look like this, we also have tracks that look like this. Anybody got an idea what that might be? I think we all have a pretty good picture of the shape of a human foot, and that's pretty hard to miss. Well, he's sure this is carved, it's fake, And I was somewhat intimidated by that because this one just really looked too good to be true. And so we looked around to see if we could find some that weren't quite so good, which we were able to do. We'll come back to that one in a moment. In the lower right-hand corner, we see one in a sequence of three that had just been uncovered. These rocks have just been removed to reveal this sequence of dinosaur tracks with a human track. Actually, the Dallas Crime Lab examined this one, and it was revealed to be very, very human-like, and they said it was definitely a human track. But some had said, well, they're carved, or erosion sometimes just accidentally makes some pretty strange-looking things. And so Stan Taylor decided to follow the trail of two tracks in the river back up under the riverbed, removing about 6 feet of alternating layers of clay and limestone and clay and limestone. And if those tracks continue back up under the riverbed, what would that say about the carved hypothesis? That'd pretty well rip it, wouldn't it? Well, he found nine more, for a total of 11. We've now extended that to 14, that continued back up under the riverbank. Looking at some of them, they're just very, very detailed. You see the strong mud push up around it. They're not carved. They came from under the overburden. And, of course, that mud push up around it also argues against that. Well, this caused a great deal of attention and excitement. And finally, Glenn Kuban came up with an explanation. And in fact, he got Humanist of the Year for this idea. He says, look at these duck-like tracks. They erode to look like the track there on the right, but the elongated dinosaur tracks erode to look like the one down at the lower right-hand corner, which is kind of human-like. And so these are just eroded dinosaur tracks. And that's his explanation, and he got Humanist of the Year. Obviously, they were very concerned about these tracks. But when you look carefully at these tracks, you see that the infill is resistant to erosion, and often the tracks become sharper and clearer with erosion. The center part is resisting, whereas the material around it is eroding away, and boy, it's getting sharper and clearer. It's not eroding to look like a human foot. You look at a side view of that, and you can see that raised center, resistant to erosion, and it's becoming sharper and clearer, and that's doesn't fit his explanation at all. In fact, you look at some of the casts that were produced by Stan Taylor at this expedition, and does that look like an eroded dinosaur track? I don't think so, especially when you put a human foot in it. That just fits entirely too perfectly. I was trying to play the devil's advocate and say, you know, how do you explain this away? And this is the one that stumped me. I mean, this really persuaded me. You have to look at this carefully in order to see what's here. This is the dinosaur track. It's about 25 inches. And you see a number of the, actually 134 dinosaur tracks on this platform. But look what stepped in the middle of that dinosaur track. You have all five toes and instep and heel, and when you put your foot in there, it just feels like a glove. I mean, it just fits perfectly right within the dinosaur track. When I presented this at a science meeting at State University up in Tennessee the first time, Glenn Kuban was there, and he went berserk. He's the one that got the Humanist of the Year, and now he's going to lose his notoriety. And he got in a plane the next morning, was in the river that afternoon with an iron bar, and this is what the track looked like when he got through with it. That's the way people deal with evidence that they don't like. We, of course, have excellent documentation, stereo photographs, cast, and the photographs you've seen. I don't think he hurt the evidence at all. As we go further up the same trail, we see another one. The three-toed dinosaur track is seen in the front part of this track, but again, something stepped toward the back of it. Sometimes they're across and sometimes beside. And, of course, within provides some of the best evidence to show that they were certainly contemporary. Looking at a side view of this same track, here to the right you see the three toes almost flush of the dinosaur track, but the depressed portion is very human-like, and it fits just perfectly. Now, this one is a right. Directly ahead of it should be a left, which is exactly what you see. And it's right, left for a sequence of 14 in a right-left pattern. This one has the dinosaur track beside it. It's not within, but beside. Looking at a side view of that same track, you can see the 25-inch dinosaur track beside it. And then just behind and beside is that 11.5-inch human foot that's consistent throughout that area. The whole sequence is seen here, 14 in a right-left pattern. 134 dinosaur tracks on the entire platform. We've highlighted here the Brontosaurus trail going right across it. Now, the value of the sequence that we see here is illustrated when we look up in the sky and we see birds. It just happens to look like a bird. Or you look up there, you might say, wow, that cloud looks like a buffalo. However, when you look a little further, you begin to get a little suspicious here, don't you? Somebody's been messing with the clouds if you see several in a row. You look at the face of this escarpment and you see the old man in the mountain. Well, did somebody do this or was this erosion? Well, you might have questions about that. How would you tell? Well, if you see four old men in the mountain, you know this is not erosion, don't you? When you see 14 in a right-left pattern, you know this is not erosion. It's not carved because it was excavated from under the overburden. It's not erosion because you've got the right-left pattern that implies what we see with Mount Rushmore. When we do the analysis, there are 14. All of them have at least a general human shape. They're very consistent in length, actually more consistent than the dinosaurs. Some of them are still being revealed. Seven of them have individual toes. We've, of course, showed you the better ones. Mary Leakey's tracks over in Africa, you may be familiar with some of those that were in National Geographic. None of those had, they had the great toe you could see, but none of the individual toes. You can distinguish rights from lefts in 12 of the 14. When Glenn Kuban shows these, guess which two he shows? The ones you can't distinguish. And they're just kind of oblong shapes. But 12 of them you can, and they are consistent in placement. That is, rights where the rights ought to be, lefts where the lefts ought to be. Completely consistent. In fact, we did a double-blind test at Kansas State University with the psych department, just pitching the pictures of the footprints out on the table. And students, one by one, came in, what are they? 97% said they look like footprints. Then we got real rough on them. Tell us which one is right and which one is left to see if we're not just seeing the rights and lefts where we think they ought to be. And there was 87% confirmation of our conclusions, and none of them were consistently different. Now, when you see 12 out of 14, that's about 87%. That's a confirmation with a double-blind test of exactly what we had concluded. This is the way you do science. Now, Dawkins is sitting behind his desk at Oxford, won't come look, he knows their car. Somebody's out doing the work, the science, the testing, and I think you can see who that is, and it's not the evolutionist. I think this is excellent evidence. Their response was, well, you need more evidence. Always. I mean, that's just the standard. If you don't like the conclusion, you need more evidence. So we look, this trail that's coming across here, the Brontosaurus Trail, is very interesting. We followed that back down the river. There was a drought in 2000, and we helped the drought. We pumped that river dry, watered the fields on either side for about 2 months, and exposed the longest consecutive dinosaur trail that's ever been found on the American continent. 156 consecutive tracks for over 500 feet, and they are just spectacular. Not only the longest trail, I think it's the best trail on the American continent. So, creationist geologists are getting some significant things done. Got it published. Lots of envious, angry evolutionists around. We know what dinosaur tracks look like. Here's a bunch of them, but there are no human tracks there at all. On up ahead, you see different tracks. They're not dinosaur tracks at all, as we have shown you. Well, they said, that's interesting, but you still need more evidence. Okay. Let's excavate up ahead of this fellow standing at the end of the trail. We had to go down about three layers to come down to the print layer on that platform. And there we found about 100 dinosaur tracks, but sure enough, going right through the middle is a trail of human tracks. This is a different individual. His are about 10 inches, his feet are about 10 inches long. The other one was 11 and a half. Looking at a close-up in the center, notice that these are different type dinosaur tracks. This is more like the duck track. They're slightly raised. That infill material is harder. But look what stepped in the right, in the track on the right. And it's a depressed track. Looking at a close-up of that track, we see the slightly raised dinosaur track. But the depressed track is very different, surrounded by the strong mud push-up, which defines, I mean, you recognize that shape immediately. Very dramatic. You actually count the knuckles in the toes with this track, and it's in a sequence of 15 in a right-left pattern. Many of the rest of them are very clear. These provide just really good evidence. The Taylor Trail and the second one, the McFall Trail. Really perfect turvy fossils because we know they're not intrusional. That is, you can't erode this and redeposit it. Can't fall down a crack. We know it's not carved. It was excavated from under the overburden. We know it's not erosion because you've got this right-left pattern, 14, and the other one was 15. How do you explain that? Well, I just have all kinds of fun presenting this on college campuses across the country and just sitting back and saying, okay, how do you explain this? I was at a state university up in Tennessee, presented this to the senior geology students. They all turned around and looked at the head of the department when we finished. You know, what are you going to say? And he hemmed and hawed and then finally said, well, of course, we don't know that there weren't dinosaurs back there with human feet. That's what he said. I thought a minute. I said, well, I guess that's right. We don't know that. We also don't know that there weren't humans back there with dinosaur feet. Wouldn't that make about as much sense? Wouldn't it make more sense to say these things look like dinosaur feet were made by dinosaurs and these things look like human feet were made by humans? No, he didn't agree with that. I said, well, if they were made by humans, would they look any different? And he got up and left. And I think about a third of the class became creationists that day. We baptized two of them, by the way. They just can't provide answers for it. They can talk about dinosaurs with human feet. Dr. Chuck Finsley was curator of the Dallas Museum of Natural History for 30 years, just recently retired. He came down to look at the tracks. Got a little upset about it, left, came back another time. Third time down, he said, Dr. Patton, I've got an explanation for you. I can tell you what these human-looking tracks really are. He says, I think they were made by aliens. And I kind of snickered, and he got kind of upset. And I said, well, Chuck, if they're made by aliens, I guess they'd be from a galaxy far, far away that would be more advanced than ours. What are they doing running around barefooted? And he got upset again. But this is the best they can do. It kind of reminds me of the Far Side cartoon. Here's Professor Farrington and the controversial theory that dinosaurs were actually discarded chicken bones of giant alien picnickers. It's pretty far out. But I don't think it's very scientific. If you want to draw cartoons, I think the better and more realistic picture would be something like this. I think they were running from the catastrophe of the flood, leaving imprints in the flood deposit, and these were the fellows that missed the boat. But summarizing, the column is a conceptual correlation. It's not something that you find when you dig down in the earth. The topsy-turvy fossils falsify evolution, and we see that from the Malachite man. We see it with the fossil footprints that are supposed to be 100 million years removed from dinosaur tracks, and they're stepping on each other's footprints. I think the concept is tested and falsified. All right, let's see if some of you have some questions at this point. We went 40 minutes instead of 30, but we'll be shorter on the second one. Yes, sir. Water is very effective at sorting both for shape and size and density. And in fact, you go to the beach and you can see sorting there at the edge, the more coarse trash and then the finer trash. I don't think that would account for the kind of segregation we see with Ordovician and Silurian and Devonian. I think that's probably ecology. But it certainly would have some effect. Yes. Actually, the water comes out of the volcano. The H and the O, H2O, gets together, forms juvenile water, and it's spewing water out of it. The explosions, not because water gets in it, it's from other things, gases that expand dramatically. That's why you got the little bubbles in the pumice that results from it. Yes, sir. It's very interesting to study that, and the Taylor Trail is the one where I've spent most of the time. You can see a rather normal pace initially, and that one that was just real clear that got bashed, he stopped, and that's a standing print. And you have different signatures indicating standing, walking, running, but he stopped right there. You can tell as they get closer together, the next one is the shortest and actually overlaps. So he had stopped, he lost his momentum, the next one overlapped, and from that point on they get further and further apart. He was speeding up, and the last one is a pretty good ways apart. So we see him going normally, he stopped, he started again, but you can walk in those, and I have no problem doing it. Now, at 11 and a half inches, if his proportions were average, he would have been 6'4". I'm not 6'4", but I could, with a little effort, have no problem stepping in those footprints. The pace works fine. Yes? Of what? I'd love to find something like that. Sometimes I think the Lord manages the kind of evidence that we get. I'd love for the Lord, after the resurrection, to just jump right out there in the middle of the Sanhedrin and say, "Here I am." You know, that would have been neat. But He didn't. He provided enough evidence, good evidence, for honest hearts, but also room for dishonest hearts to deny. And so, no, we haven't seen absolute proof of that. We've seen some indications, but no, we haven't seen that. This is pretty good stuff right here. They're stepping in each other's footprints. You know they're not 100 million years apart at that point. Yes. Okay. Good question. These are kind of like footprints in a sidewalk. And obviously the sidewalk formed quickly, that means the same implication here. Between the layers are about 8 to 10 inches of clay. And so you remove the layer and then you carefully remove the clay, and that really helps preserve. This is perfectly designed to, designing quotes here, it's an ideal situation for preserving the tracks in the surface. That where, now sometimes at the bedding plane, even without the clay, it's preserved because it just fits together, hand and glove almost, and it just lifts off at the bedding plane. It separates naturally, but at this point the clay insulates. So you've got about 8 to 10 inches of clay between the layers. Yes, and by the way, the clay is about 40% bentonite. If you've worked in the oil industry, you know that's a mineral, but it's from volcanic ash. Now, what's volcanic ash doing in Texas? Well, I think those 10,000 volcanoes were blowing material out and settling out all around the world. And part of it settled out there in Texas during this catastrophe of the flood. Yes, sir. They were first found there was a big flood in 1910. Charlie Moss, who was one of the old timers there at Glen Rose, remembers that and has told that story many times. He's passed away fairly recently. The human footprints weren't recognized until the 40s when Roland T. Byrd of the American Museum of Natural History excavated and reported on these tracks and said in Science Magazine some of them looked like human tracks, and they just kind of ignored him because they didn't. But he wasn't all that serious because he's an atheist, evolutionist, and he said, well, they look like it. It can't be, but that's what it looks like. And actually said that. They really came to notoriety, though, in the early 70s when Stan Taylor did that excavation. There's more to the story. It wasn't all revealed. With a little bit more erosion, after he did excavate, more detail showed up, detail that wasn't visible initially. And initially, all he could see was the human tracks. He didn't realize that there were dinosaur tracks there as well. And many times they're flush, and it took more erosion to show up the dinosaur tracks. And so when the dinosaur tracks begin to show up, they say, whoa, maybe we made a mistake here. But then with further erosion and more study, we found out they were right both times. Both of them are true. And just very obviously so. So it took a while to get that all figured out. Yes? Is there any means of collecting these tracks? I wish. They're in the middle of the river. This belongs to the state of Texas. It's a serious offense to damage them. If we could have gotten the two that saw the fellow out there with the iron bar damaging the track, we could have put him in jail. But they had a son who's in politics there, a county commissioner, and he's got to run for re-election, and he didn't want to offend anybody, especially the evolutionist. And so he told his mom and dad, who saw this, not to testify, and they didn't. And they have since passed away. I'd love to have put him in jail. But no, we can't do anything to the tracks. Now, most of the time they're underwater. And a layer of mud will cover the bottom. And so they're somewhat protected. And this is very hard rock. Now, some of the tracks up on a higher level, several layers up, and 100 yards upstream, fall site is called, are not nearly as resistant. They come up, we can find them fairly easily, but then they come apart within days almost, certainly weeks. A lot of clay in the limestone is friable and comes apart, but we've seen some good tracks up there. But there's really not anything we can do right now. In fact, a lot of these have eroded rather significantly at this point. Yes? Yes, and I'm not sure they have. It's obvious that he did for some of the evidence that we'll be looking at in the second half tonight. We know they survived the flood. It had to have been on the ark. I can't say it's proved, and I'll not make the claim, but I'll just say there's some pretty good indication they're not all gone. In the Congo and some places we're investigating, and I'm predicting that there's going to be some breaking news within the month. Maybe before the week's out. There's some exciting things going on right now, today. But that's all I can say right now. We want to wait till we get the good evidence. Yes?
Yes, sir.
There are lots of people willing to compromise. And the extent to which they compromise is just mind-boggling sometimes. I was telling someone the other evening about testifying there before the State Textbook Committee. Another fellow who testified this last time was the preacher for the First Baptist Church in Austin, Texas. And he got up and just really chided the audience. He says, "You Christians need to recognize you've been on the wrong side of this issue, that evolution has been proven by the scientist, and you need to learn that God is not a creationist." That's what he said. Just because it comes from a preacher doesn't mean it's going to have much resemblance to the truth. And many of them are willing to compromise with just almost any kind of pressure. And I think it's sickening. We thank you very much for your questions, your attention. Let's take a break for about 5 minutes, and we've got some more really exciting evidence to show you, and it won't take quite as long this second time. Five minutes.